Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Anne Lamott has taught a lot of writers how to write, or at least how to keep their butts in their chairs, pounding out really horrible first drafts to push their stories forward. And frankly, a lot of people want to write like Anne Lamott. She's the author of essential books such as Bird by Bird, Operating Instructions, and Hallelujah Anyway, Rediscovering Mercy. Her fans rarely buy one copy of her latest book. They tend to buy, six, one to read and five to give away. Her latest book is called Almost Everything, Notes on Hope, and it's both a lamentation and a psalm. Most of all, it's Anne Lamott at her smartest, funniest, and her kindest. What more can you ask for on a Tuesday? Anne Lamott joins us now on the phone. Welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
How are you today?
Introduction.
It seems like you're on a book tour for a book about hope, and every day the news is probably challenging. What's the tone of the book tour for your fans? You know, when every day there's something new to sort of reach for hope in defense of.
Everywhere I go, people are really stricken with the exhaustion of hanging on, and the knowledge that while we're in a huge church or auditorium or something, all being so glad to be with each other and talking about love and truth and healing, that while we were there, something just God awful may have happened. So, and that's an exhausting way to live. And what I have found what I wanted to offer in almost everything is that the things that we've been in terrible, scary circumstances before, both as a nation and in our families and in our communities, and what worked before will work again. We just forget because each time it seems like the worst it's ever been. And this time we've crossed over some kind of line that means that what worked before really, really won't work again. So I just want to always remind people that we stick together, we take care of the poor. If we're writing, we try to get our work done. If we're co-creating in any way at all, we really, really try to see if this pain and rage and fear can be transformed somehow into art or medicine. And then I always try to help people laugh again. I've always said that laughter is carbonated holiness, and I really believe in that. And once we're laughing again, it's such a surprise for people to find themselves laughing when things just really couldn't be more dire or just more bizarre. And I offer what I have to offer, which is my own take on things, which is that we will come through. And that there are certain things that contribute to that. One is radical self-care, that we put our own oxygen mask on first, that we get ourselves a lovely cup of tea, that we get a little bit of fresh air, that some of us, I call us the over 30s, I'm actually 64, but the over 30s sometimes need a little nap. Nap is a spiritual act. And then I remind people of what we've always done outside of the self-care, and that is that we register people to vote. We take care of the poor. We show up to visit our uncle, even though he's really cranky and he was really mean last time. And we go to his elder care, and we say hi to everyone in the hallways, and we stop and listen. And we donate. Miracles take money. And so it's been the most beautiful, beautiful book tour of my life because people are so real and so human right now, and everybody's getting out of themselves to take care of others. Like just at Pittsburgh on, was it Saturday, the young people mobilized everyone else into these beautiful candlelit rallies and coming togethers. And that fills you with hope. I mean, right now, Pittsburgh is inspiring the whole world, even though it's the greatest tragedy you can remember. And then I was just talking to somebody from Santa Rosa, and I said last year during the fires in the wine country, Santa Rosa inspired the whole world. It looked like nuclear bombs had fallen up there. Tens of thousands of people and a million acres of God's own country destroyed and lives lost, and yet the grace and the community and the service and the generosity just could bring tears to your eyes and give you hope.
When you were a younger writer just starting out and doing some of that writing, if you could go back now and whisper in her ear, now that you're a writer on this kind of book tour, what would you tell her?
I would just tell her that she was onto something, and that it was different, and that that it really didn't matter what the critic at the New York Times thought. You didn't have to live in fear of being criticized by New York males, but that it was internalized and it was going to come up a lot, and that when it did, we would very nicely thank it for sharing and try to distract it with, you know, sorting the socks or something like that. I would just tell her that if you don't want to be criticized, you're in the wrong business. But if you're trying to be one of the storytellers for the culture, because we're saved by stories, you know, Barry Lopez said that sometimes we need a story more than we need food. If you're going to be a storyteller and a truth teller and try to offer medicine, which is truth, you're going to get criticized. It just has nothing, and what people say has nothing to do with who you are.
Mm. Did you have your own, you know, for those of us who, you know, discovered Natalie Goldberg's work, Writing Down the Bones, and the writing book Bird by Bird, it seemed like at the time that this was completely new and didn't exist before. And I wonder, when you were writing, did you have your own Bird by Bird? Did you have something that guided you and inspired you like that book has inspired so many people? Or is that why you wrote it, because it didn't exist?
Well, I've always written stuff. I always told my writing students to write what they'd love to come upon, because then it will exist. And when I wrote my first, this is kind of a long answer, but when I wrote my first novel, Hard Laughter, it was about my father's diagnosis of brain cancer, and I was 23, and people just didn't talk about death in the mid-70s. You know, it was unseemly. And so there were almost no books on a family trying to survive an unsurvivable loss. And our family, you know, we were funny, and it was very hard to laugh sometimes. And so I wanted to write the book that I needed, which was kind of a survival 101 in a absolutely heartbreaking situation. And then when I wrote Operating Instructions, what I needed was for someone to be really truthful about what it's like. I was a single mother with no money. I had a baby in 1989. And I needed someone to say, you're going to get in touch with your anger. I had a colicky infant, and I needed people to say, all mothers, all parents at some point will be bored to tears with the little darling. I had thoughts like leaving the baby really nicely bundled up outside just for one night so I could get one night's sleep. And mothers had always thought this. All mothers have thought that. And no one had put it down on paper, because you don't want to look crazy or like you're a bad mom, because there's just such a myth and a fetishization of motherhood. And so when I said what I needed to come upon, which was somebody saying, you know what, I know exactly what you mean, I could breathe again. I get my sense of humor back, and laughter really is carbonated holiness, and it would be like going to church. And so when I wrote Bird by Bird, I wanted to say to people what no one at writing conferences where I taught, or really anywhere, were saying in books, which was you probably won't get published, and if you do, you may not make enough with your first book to retire on, and for absolutely no that publication will not make you have really good self-esteem all the time. It will tear you down as much as everything does. And no one had said that before. And the books that I read were really more on craft. And I read the Paris Review interviews. And I just have to say two words out loud to someone. 1 hour. There's all these people on our property working, and they all seem to need to talk to me right now as if I know anything at all about gravel. But anyway, the Paris Reviews, when I was coming up, the interviews with famous writers saved me. They weren't about the psychology of it and the disappointment that's marbled in with publication, but they were really about how to write, how these people all wrote. So that's what I immersed myself in. I mean, there were thousands of them. There were so many, and they just saved me.
Almost Everything Notes on Hope is the new book, and it feels like, well, first of all, you made a lot of booksellers very happy for their Christmas season, but I want to talk about a few of these things that are in the book, and the first line from chapter 2, Inside Job, there's almost nothing outside you that will help in any kind of lasting way unless you are waiting for a donor organ. Tell us where this comes from. This comes from that we all want to help so much, and we all want help from the outside. Talk a little bit about our desire to fix and help and sort of just mold the people around us into better people than they already are.
It's so natural to believe that you have good ideas for other people's lives, and that if they just did what you think they should do, then they would have a really happy, productive life. And it's just so insulting to do this with grown children. You know, they are, they're on their own hero's journey. Mm. And I said in Almost Everything that my son is 29 and I would still like to run beside him with, you know, sunscreen and a juice box. And it's not helpful to him. Our help is often really toxic. And our help hurts people because it keeps them from what helped us grow up and change and mature, which was hardship and struggle and limbo. And so I wrote a lot in this book that help is the sunny side of control, and that everything in us wants to fix and rescue and manage and manipulate people into doing what we're so sure is a good path for other people. And so I kind of forgot the original question, but one of my favorite topics is the hardship of releasing people to their own destiny. I mean, especially if they're drinking or using. My son recently had 7 years clean and sober, but there were a few years there where I thought I was trying to keep him alive, but everything I did just made him need to resist even more forcefully than he had been before. And when I finally realized that our problems aren't the problem, our solutions are the problem, and my solutions to somebody else's problems, my really precious son, when I realized I was the problem, that he had to figure out his own path and whether or not he wanted to stay alive and do the work, then everybody started to get better. So I wanted to share that because I'm not sure who else is talking about that at a public level.
Right. And there's this notion of everything being a paradox, of so much of the paradox of life, because you can say, you know, those answers aren't, they don't exist outside of you, but some people might pick up this book and say, oh, that was just the answer I needed to hear. So talk a little, if you will, about the beautiful paradox of life.
Well, I hate it a lot of the time. I want to say I hate the beautiful truth that all truth is a paradox. But I just wish there were certain things we could all agree on that would be permanently true. I use the example that when I was coming up, they always said that light was light waves. And hold on, I'm having a little cough. And then So you come up, you believe light is like the undulations in the ocean. Then it turns out that light is particles, like grains of sand. So, okay, so I can live with that. And then it turns out that light is both at the same time lives in particles. I just think that's unnecessary. And then it turns out that when you observe light, you change it. And I feel like, come on now. Can't like the particle people just surrender to the waves people, or can't they at least be separate? And sometimes they're waves, you know, and life is like that too. That's one of the things that gives me hope, is no matter how ghastly and grim and cold things seem, if all truth is paradox, which I believe it is, then there is also some incredible blessing or healing or benevolent surprise enfolded into that. So that's why I wanted to write about it, because one of the things that's made our country just so in such ruinous shape is that we all think we're right. I certainly do. I think I'm right. And if I didn't, then I would have other ideas, which I would then think were the right ones. And so to start to challenge your own conviction that you're right, and that other people should try to correct other people's thinking, is just a guarantee that you're going to have a miserable, clenched life. Right. And in fact, I started this book when I just got so sick and tired of being sick and tired of my own judgment, my own clench, my own hatred. So to me, the most important chapter in the book is called Don't Let Them Get You to Hate Them.
Yeah.
Because we fuse with people we hate and we become them. And in that, it's like a really there's a lot of really miserable blessing in some of this stuff, like in confronting your own hatred or judgment or, you know, feelings of victimization. And so I wanted to offer my grandson and my niece, this niece, a different perspective on very, very hard times, that yes, it's true, and breathe, you know, breathe and you get thirsty people water, and maybe take a brief nap and try to get outside and listen for birdsong. And it's all kind of mixed in together, which I don't love. You know, there's blessing and catastrophe and grace and cataclysm and death and new life. And I think I said in the last book, Hallelujah, anyway, because I'm a very tense person, if I were God's West Coast representative, I'd have it more organized like a silverware drawer. And all the really scary, bad things might be where the knives are, and all the things that are a blessing or transformative would be where the bigger forks are, you know, and so on. And it would just be nice and orderly, but it's not. It's like somebody tips the silverware all into one pile. But if you look at what looks like a catastrophe, a disaster, or a mess, or chaos, look around for the beautiful things. Look around for the moments of grace. Look around for the patches of light.
The book is called Almost Everything, Notes on Hope. It is a patch of light. Anne Lamott, thank you, thank you, thank you.
You're so welcome. Thank you.